You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Make a high impact contribution. I think most career advice can in some way be boiled down to that. So, I mean, the first step, if I was someone early in my career, I'd probably want to know, how do I even know what a high impact contribution is?
Why did I become an executive coach? I saw lots of great people fail to get ahead at work, while their much less talented peers blew right past them. That made me furious, but also curious. What were great people getting wrong? It came down to helping them re-examine what drove success and then helping them make critical shifts, one hard truth at a time.
Feel like you're doing everything you were told, but you're not moving ahead at work nor having the impact you seek? Then welcome to 97% Effective with Michael Winderoth, where we skip feel-good, happy talk and engage experts in pointed conversations about what it really takes to move the needle at work and your career. So if you feel stalled or frustrated or seek that extra edge as you move to the next level, then look no further. This is the Hard Truths Playbook you never got.
Hi, I'm Michael Winderoth, and you're listening to 97% Effective, the annual ritual. Another crop of new college graduates enters the workforce. Those grads, boom, suddenly you're in a new world, one that universities and your academic work don't always prepare you for. Having a boss, not having a standard final exam that reflects your grade and performance and ensures your ascent, and having to take charge of your own career. Today, I'm excited and honored to speak to Axel Orstrom, 3 years out of college, to get his fresh perspective on how he has navigated the working world. Axel works at Amazon Web Services, no stranger to any of us. He works in strategy and operations, and he joined AWS right after the global pandemic. He was immediately, as is very typical at Amazon, thrown into the intense working world there, expected to manage 20 priorities, serve key executives across the company very quickly, all while working extremely lean and doing it all remote. We're going to talk candidly about what has helped him most as he started off his career, and even call out some of those cliches and happy talk, the career advice he got along the way that did not serve him. Axel hails from Sweden and holds a BA in economics from Carleton College, where he graduated in 2021. And I want to share a personal and telling story about Axel that will give you some idea of who he is. So years back, I am also a graduate of Carleton College. I went back to give a career talk, a talk that actually was very early on and became many of the central ideas that are in my book, Get Promoted. Well, it turns out that Axel, who was a junior at that time, was not invited to that talk, was a small group lunch, because it was meant for graduating seniors. But he snuck in anyway. And later that same day, we had a one-on-one career talk, which he had proactively sought out, actually only one of two students who provided compelling reasons that wanted me to stay longer and have those conversations. And that showed a lot of proactive planning and also whether you want to call that breaking or bending things in ways that serve you and your goals. So Axel, welcome to 97% Effective.
Thanks, Michael. Happy to be here.
So, Axel, what caused you to sneak into that talk? And if it was the free pizza at the time, I'm not going to be offended.
No, certainly not the free pizza, although that was a nice bonus. But, you know, thinking back to that time, I was a junior in college. It's kind of that period where you're really looking to get that junior summer internship, which can really make or break. You know, you can get that return offer and have a sort of job security coming into your senior year. And really what I was feeling in that period was, I mean, first of all, Carleton is a small school, so there's not a lot of on-campus recruiting from these sort of major finance and tech firms. And that was where I was trying to go. And I just felt like a lot of the career advice I'd been receiving to just kind of submit your application, you know, do your best on your resume, and you know, that should take you far enough, was not panning out. And so when I heard about your talk and sort of the candid, straightforward, no BS career advice that you were kind of pitching there, I was really interested, and I was not going to let the seniors only sign on the door stop me from hearing that advice. So, yeah.
An interesting reflection, and I'll add to this. I don't know if folks out there have read Adam Grant's great book, Originals, but he does look at innovators and those who kind of break through, and really comes down to people who do things differently or don't get stopped. And one of the examples he uses, if you've been, you know, defaulted on your computer to have whatever the web browser is, and you take the time to go and download another, his research showed that that was a sign of those who take the other path and the extra effort who are the originals. That talk, looking back on it, when I gave it at the time, I actually don't even remember all of the content the Career Center had challenged me to present and talk. Any one thing that you found most helpful, or any one thing kind of looking back now 4 years that you would have adjusted, or if you had coached me, that you'd say you could do differently?
Yeah, I mean, similar to you, I can't say that I remember all the specifics. It's been a while, but really I remember kind of the broad takeaway that I had was, prior to that, I had seen office politics as this kind of almost force of nature, that it's sort of, when it comes to touch your team, you want to kind of just keep your head down and like try not to be absorbed into it and get washed away. And following your talk, it helped me reframe it as more just a kind of series of tools that everyone uses if they're going to be successful in some way. So it's less about this, I mean, you always use the term Machiavellian. It's not really as much a Machiavellian thing as it is just a kind of a toolbox, things like consensus building, tailoring to your audience, you know, making sure you have the right stakeholders in the room. And, you know, framed in the wrong way, it can seem like a very negative thing, but really it's kind of in the eye of the beholder, how it's used.
Yeah, this whole framing, to be honest, if I was back in your shoes, I don't think I stepped in the Career Center back then, but I probably would have not have attended the talk, let alone listened to parts of it. And office politics is not the focus of our conversation here, but I want to first address an elephant in the room, which is, you know, what am I going to learn from a mid 20-year-old guy who's a couple years out of college? Yeah, he works at Amazon. And I will also first preface this, that you have not been nor are a client. We simply met at that talk and we've had a couple conversations over the years. And those have been very interesting conversations, which sparked and led to this discussion. I thought a lot of people could benefit from your insights. And I do have academics, senior execs, or the coaches of those senior execs on this show, where we parse, you know, what's effective in the arc of one's career. So the elephant in the room is guests out there who are probably saying, what am I going to learn from a 20-something-year-old guy 3 years into their career?
Yeah.
You're sharp, they're thoughtful. How do you first respond to that?
So I think there's a few things. I mean, of course, I'm not going to be giving advice on how a CEO or a CFO is going to, you know, navigate the kind of board of directors and kind of C-suite dynamics. But I think there's a lot of value in hearing the perspective of someone early in their career for a few reasons. So first of all, I think the workplace has changed a lot. Of course, I didn't experience it before COVID, but post-COVID, you know, the rise of remote and hybrid work, that's one thing that I think most, if not all, listeners are going to kind of have experienced that at the same time as me. And so whether they built their connections in person and had to move into hybrid and remote, or if they changed jobs after that and are trying to kind of establish team cohesion in that environment, that's something that I think we're all on a similar level at. And so that's one thing. And then another thing is, it's true that these people have a perspective from the top, but they haven't experienced what it's like to be early in your career today. And they're managing people who are early in their careers today. So just hearing kind of the other side of the management relationship more candidly and kind of being able to tailor their behavior towards that.
Yeah, from having worked with a lot of senior executives, I'd say they are very disconnected from the working and life experience of 20-year-olds who, you know, more or less you guys grew up with the internet, were probably not even born when most of those individuals were well into their careers or had started their careers. And I'll add to this because I'd like to answer that question too. You know, my show here, I really try to design and bring in a diversity of guests. About half are global, not in the States, different industries. And point blank, we learn the most from those who have different perspectives. Otherwise, you're basically sitting in an echo chamber. And I would definitely agree, from someone who started his career using fax, that was from China to the States, but very quickly the next year was email. But the speed right now is profound. And AI, I know that you're on a workforce with generative AI. That is quite a paradigm shift. Let's dive into how to, you know, get your career started off right. For a little bit of context here, as I said in the intro, you join right out of the pandemic. I've coached executives at Amazon, senior managers there. Working life there is intense, hard-charging culture. And I've seen, frankly, it chew people up and pretty much spit them out if they don't manage it or are not able to focus. I know you've talked to a lot of mentors along the way. What was there anything, because the show does also want to dispense with any cliches, a cliche that you got early on that you've kind of found, yeah, this is pretty terrible advice?
Yeah, there's certainly a few there that we could talk about. But I think the number one that people my age probably hear from their parents and kind of people of that generation is kind of the trite saying, you know, just work hard and keep your head down and you'll get ahead. And working hard is absolutely a major key to getting ahead. But that second part of that statement, keeping your head down, I think is not something that serves you in the long run. So really, it's about working hard, but also advocating for yourself, trying to make sure that people know what your contribution was rather than just, oh, you know, it'll get recognized later. That doesn't always happen. So it is kind of, don't let others take credit for your work wherever possible.
As you mentioned that, you know, because this, you know, keep your head down. I'm, you know, part Chinese and I have a lot of clients over in Asia, very ingrained there. I think it's generally ingrained across the world. You are from Sweden. I know you've spent a while in the States. How do the Swedish think about this? Or was there part of that in your upbringing?
That's an interesting question. I think it's certainly a more American thing to, you know, hold up your hand and say, I did that. But having said that, the Swedes are not strangers to that entirely. So I think it might take a little more, it may take them a little longer to work up to that, let's say. For example, either A, you may let someone else take credit a few more times there before you decide, this isn't going to change unless I change it. But at the same time, the Swedes are very entrepreneurial and are kind of, you know, you have these generational companies being built there. And so there is also this tendency to go out and get it, not just wait for it. Companies like Spotify, Klarna, other kind of huge startups have come out of that small country. And it's clear that that's not something that happens just by, you know, sitting around and waiting for an incumbent to invent it or letting your boss, you know, tell you, that's not a good idea right now. Let's hold off on that.
Talking brass tacks here, Axel, and let's talk about some of those soft skill strategies kind of early on that have helped you. And I took away, these are my words, not yours, that early on you found it very important to make a strong, high impact contributions. Can you talk more about that? I mean, it's a pretty wide phrase.
Yeah. So, I mean, to your point, you know, make a high impact contribution. I think most career advice can in some way be boiled down to that. So, I mean, the first step, if I was someone early in my career, I'd probably want to know, how do I even know what a high impact contribution is? And so part of figuring that out, I think, is really working to understand your boss, maybe even your boss's boss and other key stakeholders you're working with. So A, you know, what format, what deliverables are they looking for? Just anticipating that. And then secondly, you know, what are their real priorities? Is it, you know, if your boss's boss is asking for one thing and you have a sort of maybe a lateral stakeholder that has a little bit less organizational influence is asking for another thing, you might want to think about, well, how, you know, what is my manager going to want to prioritize here? And with that in mind, you know, you're still going to do both, but which are you going to try to deliver first and, you know, put more effort into in the short term to make sure that your manager and your is pleased that they're looking good for their manager. So that's one example. A second example would be to proactively offer help and sort of hold up your hand when you see a project that maybe you weren't immediately recruited onto, but it's within maybe your manager's sphere of influence. And maybe you just have a sense that it's a high impact project. So an example there was just kind of last year as generative AI was, you know, becoming the thing in tech. My team hadn't taken on any of that directly, but my boss's boss had a work stream around that. And basically I just kind of held up my hand and said, hey, how can I get involved here in kind of my any spare time I have? How can I support, you know, how can I add my bandwidth here to make the content even better around what we're delivering? And then the last one that I would call out is, you know, high impact work when you start your career is not the same thing as high impact work a year in, 2 years in. There's the expectations are higher. And so you're not just going to be able to deliver that kind of next level of impact without continuously developing yourself. So maybe in your first year, you see a project that it looked high impact, but in the moment you knew or you were pretty sure you either didn't have the bandwidth or the skills to make that happen within the constraints that you're working with. So maybe that project would have taken you, you know, 60 hours a week, but you already have to dedicate 60 hours a week on other projects. And so there's just, there isn't really a way to do that. But if you had developed programming skills or some other kind of stakeholder management ability or a soft skill, you would have been able to in a shorter amount of time. That's the scenario where you would say, okay, well, I can't do this now, but let me mark down this skill that if I develop it sort of in the next few months, the next time this opportunity comes along, I can jump on it and I can sort of level up my impact. I think those are the three main ones to summarize. That's really understanding your boss and your key stakeholders, you know, proactively holding up your hand and asking to be put on new projects that seem high impact. And then finally, continuously developing yourself so you can level up your ability to make impactful contributions.
Yeah, there's a huge part there of being a sponge. And I like what you said about kind of thinking about what's high impact now is not going to be high impact later. And I did notice on your bio, a lot of credentials there in terms of some technical things, some things around kind of project management and so forth. And these days, as you do those and get those certificates, those things kind of needed, or are they kind of also looked favorably upon, or how do you kind of view that?
I think there's a couple ways to look at it. There's the one camp of it's mostly a certificate for the resume. So, you know, maybe you already knew how to project manage, but you just learned on the job and you want to be able to have a little, you know, seal of approval from some firm that's well respected to kind of formalize that and add it to the resume, or to show your boss or your coworkers that you really do take this seriously. And so you kind of took a test to prove that you really know what you're doing there. That's one way. And I think there's a place for that. Often though, what I look at it as is more so, what's a skill that I want to accelerate the learning path? Maybe I'll develop this over the course of the next year or 18 months So for example, I got a project management certification. A lot of my job is involved in kind of managing projects and sort of larger programs that involve a lot of different teams and key stakeholders. And it was something that I was picking up on the job, you know, being a sponge is certainly a key there, but just kind of taking a step back and looking at it, I saw that I don't think I'm going to be at the level I want to be if I continue at the current rate in the next kind of 9 months or so. But if I basically force myself in my free time to study up for this exam, take this course, then I'll be able to sort of accelerate that path. And then, you know, I won't be focusing my attention on learning that anymore. I'll just be applying those skills and be able to kind of rededicate those learning resources or neurons towards other skills. So again, I think it comes back to the what's high impact now isn't going to be high impact in a year. And the more you can pack in, I guess the more learning time you can pack in any given week, month, or quarter, the faster you're going to be able to reach that next level.
I like that phrase you used of kind of accelerating the path. It's a nice reframe on the way I used to think about it early on of I'm going to get displaced if I don't do these things.
Oh, look, there may be some of that too, but you know, it's almost like compounding yourself of like, if I only have, you know, the basics of Excel right now, I have to spend all this time getting to intermediate and advanced. If I have all the sort of advanced level of Excel, then maybe I can start learning Visual Basic for applications, which is like basically the programming language in Excel, or, you know, other more advanced things that I can then kind of integrate into my workflow and basically just become more efficient, do more work in the same or less amount of time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's talk about joining and working remote. And I mentioned, because we had talked before, that literally probably a third or a quarter of your college period was done taking classes remote, something I think no one had ever gone through. As you've joined Amazon, a lot of your work is remote. How did that experience, do you feel, kind of better prepared you for remote work?
Yeah, that's a great question. So first, I'll just preface this by saying that I think studying remote and working remote are not perfectly, you know, interchangeable. There are differences there. So studying already has sort of a lot of inherent, you know, solo work time. In person, you would have been maybe at the library or in your dorm room or something. Now, maybe you're, you know, in your bedroom at home or, you know, something like that. But that part, that's easier to translate. The harder part is like when you're in class and or when you're in a meeting at work. How do you, you know, keep focused on the task? There's a lot more distractions in to use the example again, in your bedroom at home versus in the lecture hall at school. So one thing that I kind of picked up on quickly during that COVID remote period was just because you're not required to have an organized remote learning space does not mean that you shouldn't. Yes, it may feel, you know, convenient, but for me at least, an organized workspace contributes to an organized headspace. So basically, if I've got all this clutter just outside the view of the camera, yeah, the lecturer can't see that, but it's in some way, you know, weighing on my mind. So that's one. Second would be, again, you're not required to, but even when the camera's off, I think there's value in dressing at least, you know, somewhat, not professionally, but let's say you're not wearing sweatpants and like a hoodie at all times. Because again, I think, you know, forcing yourself to go through some of those routines that maybe you wouldn't if you weren't seeing anyone, but you are still going to have to be social in this setting. And it can just make you feel a little more put together, a little more focused. So, you know, maybe wear at least a t-shirt or like a collared shirt, even when the cameras aren't going to be on. And then the final one, really, I think this is the most important. If you're only going to take one away, it is camera optional. Is I would say, unless something really is going on in your home or you're really feeling sick or something, no one wants to see you, you know, with a runny nose and coughing and all that. But otherwise, camera on as much as possible. It really helps you build a connection with someone. And it also helps, you know, it's a little bit of a you know, keep the focus here is what's on the screen. It's not what's next to me on the desk, or even, you know, keeps you from opening another tab and you know, multitasking. Really, it helps you focus on the other person and try to kind of build that connection there. So, you know, organized workspace, dressing professionally, or at least not too casually, and then really camera on as much as possible within reason.
And Axel, you're very thoughtful about that. How did you arrive at those insights?
Honestly, it's mostly on the kind of self-reflection side. And it may not be, oh, today, what were the things that worked and didn't work in the remote setting? But there might, often it's more kind of a feeling that might build over a couple of weeks or a month, and then trying to kind of trace back what is driving that feeling. So, you know, if we talk the organized workspace, I mean, I certainly wasn't perfect when, you know, in March 2020, when we first went remote, I was trying to carve out, you know, where's a good place to do my work. I got all these notebooks, textbooks, things stacked on the desk around me, you know, maybe a water bottle, something like that. And, you know, over time, I had a feeling like, why is it hard for me to focus in class? And then, you know, it's almost like the scientific method. You're like, well, maybe it's that I'm just not trying hard enough. Okay, let's try harder. No, that's still, I don't think that's it. Then, okay, maybe it's the class. And then I identify, no, okay, well, you know, one or two of my classes are perhaps more of a, you know, checking the box for the graduation requirement and are not as interesting, whereas others I was pretty confident were interesting and I just was still having trouble paying attention. So sort of trial and error there on that one, and on the dressing professionally, just like, you know, oh, maybe it's because I'm wearing sweatpants and I just don't feel like I'm taking this as seriously as if I was wearing something a little bit more put together. The last one, the camera on, I think that one it's a bit of both. I mean, feedback wise, I would say during college in large classes, I still wasn't turning the camera on for a lot of it. It was really when I got to Amazon that I identified that, first of all, you match to what the other person does. So if they turn their camera on, you know, you're not keeping it off. But then I found that I'm kind of thinking back, this meeting worked very well. I felt very connected. This one didn't. And sort of slowly I was tracing back, it's the camera off meetings where it's easy to kind of lose some context, misunderstand. Maybe the stakeholder relationship doesn't feel as smooth. And then, you know, conversely, why is this relationship working so well? Why did this meeting go very well? We got done much earlier than I expected. Why was that? Camera was on. Okay, there's something here. And sort of just noticing those trends and incorporating them as you kind of learn what works best. And just really, taking the lessons. Don't just, oh, maybe it's the camera off, and then never acting on it. Like, definitely act on things as you notice them constantly adjust your perspective as you go.
Yeah, I really like the structured reflection, whether you call it that or not, is one thing that I try to get a lot of executives who are also working at a pace that's incredible. No one stops and looks at it. But then that other piece of actually trying a few things, right? Of, okay, how might I do this differently?
You've been listening to 97% Effective with your host, executive coach Michael Winderoth. If this interview is making you think, make sure to share it with a friend. Now, back to our interview.
I wanted to ask you, I think you covered it pretty comprehensively about the taking advantage of training, and particularly this, you know, joining the generative AI task force, the kind of raising your hand to accelerate. It feels like there's also a lot of wisdom in there. Anything else that you want to add to what you had said before?
Yeah, that's a good question. This is going to sound a little trite, but follow your interests. So even some, you know, there's the one side of this is a skill that will, you know, I can tangibly see how this will impact my day-to-day work. Right now, it's something I feel I'm lacking, or it takes me a long time to do, and I want to be faster, I want to be better, or I want to be able to do it at all, and I can't right now. So that's one side, and that's kind of the obvious. But then I think the second piece is sometimes there's things that you're just interested in that may not immediately feel applicable to work. But I think there's two factors there. I mean, one, just kind of fostering the continuous learning, kind of exercising that muscle as much as possible, even when it is not directly applicable to work, just makes a habit out of it. And so makes it that much easier when you're then identify a skill that will be immediately applicable to work. You've kind of, you don't have to acclimate yourself to what does learning mean for me again. And then kind of the second piece there is sometimes the skill doesn't seem immediately applicable, but as you kind of follow that interest and sort of learn more about it, you make a connection and you say, oh, well, actually, no, this is something I could apply. And I didn't even, you know, think about it at first. And now I'm like halfway down kind of this path and there's all this synergy. So I'd say, you know, skills that are applicable to work are great, but don't limit it to only those. You know, if it's interesting to you, it's probably worth pursuing further.
So that idea of not totally losing yourself and some of your passions.
Yeah, exactly. You know, we're not robots. Like, it's not only work, you know, let yourself have some fun. Maybe it'll benefit work, maybe not, but you need something to kind of some passion in your life as well.
You've talked a lot about connections, relationships. And so I'll bring up the word that a lot of people still cringe about, it, your ability to network. I'd mentioned at the outset, right? We met, you know, made a short comment to me at the end of the talk that led to a longer one. And then, you know, we haven't spoken regularly over the last 4 years, but, you know, periodically, I'd say maybe once a year, you had kind of reached out at different inflection points or just to drop a line. And I mean, it was very genuine, but it also said, yeah, let's get on the phone. Let's talk for 30 minutes about what's up. You know, particularly when you're younger in your career, and this was something I was not good at, and I think it is a kind of sometimes a learned skill. When you're younger, you have kind of less to offer, say, or you know, to those in power who are more senior. What were some of the effective ways you found to open doors, start to build a useful network, not only for now, but in the future? I think a lot of college students in particular would love to know kind of what your thought process was or the things that have worked for you.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think there's a few kind of pieces to that. So number one, I think I'm pretty similar to you in that it did not come naturally to me. It is something that I've, it's a skill that I have practiced. I'm not someone who's naturally just out meeting people all the time. It's something that I intentionally put an effort into because, I mean, at the end of the day, like your network is kind of a key predictor of your long-term career trajectory, success, failure even. And so building that network is very important. And so going back actually to a point another guest on your show made that I found very insightful, Michael Melcher, the author of Your Invisible Network, he kind of called out that networks become more valuable over time. And so, you know, who you meet today may, you know, be a CEO in 10 years or be, you know, in the industry that they're not in the industry now that you maybe want to get into, but in 10 years, they may be well-placed in the industry and it'll be interesting to talk to them. So going back to how it's kind of done and the best practices, at least that I've found, first of all, it's a numbers game. Like, you know, you're not getting a reply to every reach out. You have to be comfortable with ghosting and also rejection. I mean, sometimes you'll get a reply and it's like, sorry, not interested. And, you know, take it in stride. One way to help maximize your odds in that numbers game is to try to kind of target people you have at least one shared interest or shared piece of your identity with. So the classic is, you know, your school alumni. That's how we connected. Partially is also just the fact that we met in person the first time and kind of maintained that. But if you hadn't come, been a student at Carleton in the past, I don't know that we would have ever met. So that's one piece. And it doesn't have to be college. It could be same hometown, same country that, you know, you're not in anymore. So like a Swede in the US, that might be a shared interest for me. You know, same company, someone who was at Amazon in the past or is still at Amazon, it's another one. That's one piece, being able to say, hey, we're similar in this way. And they might then say, oh, well, I'm senior, but I can see a little bit of myself in them. So yeah, I don't have something to offer, but maybe they wish that when they were in my position, they had that. So that's one. Secondly, keeping them concise. You know, when you're sending a message and you don't have much to offer, if you write a page or you write two pages or even a few paragraphs, I just think they're less likely to read it. Like why, you know, that's, you're creating work for them if they need to read that much. Whereas if you're sending two or three sentences, maybe a paragraph at most on just, hey, this is my name, I work here, this is our shared interest, love to talk to you about XYZ. It's much easier for them to say yes. And then I think the final one is not being, you know, don't try to sort of obfuscate the fact that you don't have much to offer. Like understand that what you're, you know, be clear about what you're looking for is here, some mentorship, some insight, maybe some career advice. You're not gonna, you know, you're not a 20 something who's gonna offer this senior executive a job. Like there, that's just never gonna happen. And so, you know, being open about that and understanding both sides of the equation, I think is the last key. So it's a numbers game. You know, make sure to set, be comfortable with rejection, find a commonality, short and sweet, and finally be open about what you're asking.
That piece about conciseness and also kind of being open and going to the point, I think is very important, you know, from getting a lot of inquiries. I just don't have the time. And so I'm thinking about, hey, you know, if I can talk to one person, which one piqued my interest and is someone I could actually help versus what should I do in the future, right? Is really putting a lot of work on the other person that they're probably not going to want to take. I'd ask you though, because as you went through that, I noticed, because we were talking about this kind of generational difference, that, you know, you didn't really integrate anything there about using technology, you know, social media. Maybe I'll ask you pointedly, is there some aspect here of technology that helps you do this to be effective in your network efforts?
Yeah, I think the sort of motions that you go through are broadly pretty similar to your kind of to the last generation, but technology makes it a lot kind of lower friction. So I'll use LinkedIn as an example because that's basically my primary tool for it. So before, if you were looking for a Carleton alumni in, you know, let's say the finance industry or something like that, you may have to kind of get access to the alumni directory, which before technology, I don't even know how you would do that. Maybe it's a binder or something, but it's online. And so that's already faster. But even on LinkedIn, you just look at some of these companies you're interested in, it'll just tell you, you know, so-and-so alumni of Carleton College, or this person is a mutual connection of this person you're already connected with on LinkedIn. So the kind of shared traits or shared kind of history, that's accelerated so much by LinkedIn. And then the second piece there is like the reach out itself. Before, you'd have to, I guess, you know, find their phone number or their mailing address. And that's totally different now. If you have LinkedIn Premium, you can send a lot of people messages without even being connected. And again, that comes down to, you know, keep it short and sweet for sure. And, you know, you can just send a lot more. You can really up the numbers game. It was a numbers game before, and now it's similarly or even more so a numbers game. But these tools help you just like, you know, hit the numbers, I guess.
And I would say, I notice a lot of younger people who reach out to me is they're not researching the other person, right? There's so much out there. People have a digital footprint. LinkedIn, you can pick up a lot. And it's amazing. Someone talks to me, they haven't done any research. They'll waste some of the time with kind of softball questions about, well, where did you get your start? It's kind of pretty obvious, right? You can see my work trajectory. But I feel like that's an area where sometimes the technology is so great now, people just take it for granted and they don't use it.
Yeah, I think you're raising that point. I'm almost taking that part for granted of that's of course kind of table stakes. You know, yeah. You're of course gonna look through their LinkedIn history and like the question is not gonna be, how did you get to this job? It might be, you know, why did you make this choice? So, you know, so you kind of cut out those getting to know you, or I guess, you know, personal history questions, and you can kind of cut straight to the more the second order questions that would have been follow-ups in that old paradigm and are now just like the conversation. And it really just helps, I think, connect much better. You can just, you can cut out all that sort of, I've told 10 people that I started at, you know, X company. Like,
right.
Yeah. So,
yeah. I like to think of it as one of the things I've kind of developed in coaching and period, you know, that I was a journalist also is, you know, that those second order questions you said that really kind of cut and make the other person to think, right? You kind of want them like, well, I hadn't thought about that. And, you know, exactly. Rather than kind of the obvious stuff, you know, so asking good questions. I'm sure ChatGPT probably has some things to say about that and helping us improve how we ask that.
Yeah.
Axel, before we go to the end, I do have a couple kind of questions and personal things I wanted to ask you. On this professional side of, you know, making an impact early on, you laid out and talked through, I think, some important areas. Anything we didn't cover that I should have asked or you want to add?
You know, it's I think less... What I'd like to add is less around those high impact things, because I do think we covered that fairly comprehensively, but kind of a different side of the remote work, which this is less, you wouldn't get this, I think, in an education setting, but in a workplace, it's about how do you build kind of the team dynamic when you're not the manager? How do you really like weave yourself into a team when you kind of join it as a new remote employee? And I think there's a few things that people can be doing there that it took me a while to learn. So the first and most important one is like, understand the value of the one-on-one meeting. When I started my career, I thought one-on-ones almost were kind of this hurdle to get through each week. It was like, okay, like I need to prove that I've been working the last 7 days. And so like, I need to kind of have a list of things I've done so they don't think I've been like, you know, messing around instead of working. And only after, I don't know, a few months, 6 months, could have been even a year. It took a long time for me to really develop that the true value of the one-on-one is not in the kind of check-in. It's in the conversation. So A, like really dedicate a little time to asking how they're doing outside of work and kind of getting to know them that way. That's one important one. And of course, I think you get that maybe in the first couple when you start a new job. And then it's very easy to fall into the trap of reporting the news. You know, I've done X on Y project.
Yeah.
This, you know, this is the next step. But really saying, how have you been this last week? Like, what's going on in your life? And sort of not just a checklist, but again, to our previous point, like the follow-up questions, make, you know, how do you think about this? And that sort of thing. Second piece is it's just an incredible place to be a sponge. So, you know, asking for advice. Like, I have this challenge in the last week. This is how I approached it, but I think it could have been done better. Have you experienced something and how would you have done that? That's an example. And it's really like, it helps you because you learn from them, but also people feel good giving advice and being asked for their opinion on things. So it also kind of, I think, raises how they think of you. And then I think the other piece here beyond the one-on-one is sort of the instant messaging piece of remote work. You know, you're on Slack, you're on Teams, you know, something like that. How do you foster kind of the team dynamic there when, you know, not only is there no video, but there's no audio, it's text only. I think that is something where over time I've kind of, you develop or you should at least try to develop a voice that you have in those messages, where maybe you like to use exclamation points. Maybe someone else feels uncomfortable using those and they're very, you know, brass tacks, like this is what I need and just kind of no BS. So it is like, find a way to inject some of your personality into those conversations, but don't go, you know, you don't need to go too far, of course, and start using like all this, you know, Gen Z slang or anything
or
like that.
Or gazillion emojis.
You know, try to, you know, your messages should, people should be able to read your messages and hear your voice.
Oh, interesting.
Them. Not just, I think, not just a sort of ChatGPT type response where, you know, it could have been anyone, right?
Yeah, yeah. I like this, the team dynamics, the power of the one-on-one and having your personality come through even in a virtual. That's really getting me to think, and I hope it's getting people to think out there as well. Axel, here towards the end, I had three final questions for you. resources that you found most useful kind of in the last couple of years, and particularly as you entered corporate, that you would just want to call out?
Yeah. I mean, look, this podcast has been fantastic. I'm not required to say that. It's just a fact. Similarly, I just think on that kind of following passions and interests and sort of continuously developing yourself, there are so many good books that kind of can help you teach these skills. And even, you know, maybe you're not going to pick every single thing out of a 300-page communications book or something. But while you're reading it, you're going to be thinking about those things a lot. And I can almost guarantee you will sort of internalize at least one or two of the lessons. And so you'll sort of, by continuously reading more of those, you're going to be building more skills. So I'll just name some examples that I really enjoyed, and a few of them have been on your show. So The Unspoken Rules by Gorik Ng, that was a great one. You recommended that to me before I started this job, and it proved to be very valuable, kind of worth its weight in gold. Another one that I also mentioned earlier was Your Invisible Network by Michael Melcher. That one helped a lot with kind of, A, you know, how do you do those cold reach outs? How do you build that network? But also, to your point, kind of the follow-ups, keeping these connections going. That's something that I was not well practiced with prior to reading that book. And it's, you know, it's almost one of those things where you read it and you think, this can't, you know, this guy's got to be BSing me. And then you use it and you're like, wait, no, this is, he was completely correct.
He's a real deal. He was my first coach also.
The lessons are great.
Michael's amazing.
You know, to your point about cold reach outs, I after I read the book, I reached out to him and said, you know, really enjoyed the book. And I got a response. It's just like, you know, a short, sweet, maybe not even asking for anything. Reach out is always great. 7 Laws of Power by Jeffrey Pfeffer.
Of course.
You know, Harvard Business Review, Think Faster, Talk Smarter podcast from Matt Abrahams from Stanford as well. Super Communicators is one I just read, which absolutely fantastic. Highly recommend that. And then another one is How to Know a Person. Those are both really on the conversation side. You know, how do you ask those great questions? How do you drive a conversation so that everyone leaves feeling kind of positively and lifted up by it?
I want to squeeze in one personal question because, you know, kind of prior to these interviews, I do prepare for them in advance. That one thing came across and caught my eye that I want to ask you about, because I think it was timed with me the other night watching, probably a little bit dated here, it was Damon and Affleck's film about Air, about Michael Jordan period. Yeah. But I read that it used to resell limited edition sneakers. I don't know. It just feels like there's something interesting there.
You know, it really started when, just as I was finishing high school, there was this cultural wave of, I don't know, like the Yeezys, the Kanye West sneakers, you know, maybe not great to talk about them now, but that was certainly an interest back then. And I just was fascinated by how hard it was to be able to spend $200 on a pair of sneakers. Like, it wasn't just, it's a $200 pair of sneakers and that's already, you know, a high enough bar. It was, you have to enter a raffle. And if you win the raffle, you don't get the sneakers for free. You get the opportunity to buy them. And then, so first of all, it was, I just wanted to try to get them. And I thought that was, you know, sort of the classic scarcity drives interest. But then once I got a couple, I was sort of clued into the fact that I'm spending $200 on these sneakers, but I can, you know, people are offering to buy them for $1,000. And so then it became, well, I don't think every pair of these limited edition sneakers, whether it's Yeezys or at the time, I think Ultra Boosts and other Adidas ones were very popular. I don't think every pair looks great, but I've kind of built the knowledge on how to get them. And so why don't I just, you know, try to get every single one, keep a few that I like and sell the ones that I don't like. And it coincided with me taking a gap year between high school and college and being in Stockholm, where there was a lot of kind of sneaker stores. So kind of building relationships there, both with people who were doing the same thing as me and with people working at the stores. Yeah, and it was just kind of a fun time. When I went to college after that, sort of kept it up a little bit for another year or two, but much less. You know, it's just a lot harder when you're kind of doing it all online. And the interest in actually wearing the sneakers waned a little bit too for me. So it's not something I still do nearly as much. But, you know, it was just like a fun way to make some money and follow an interest between high school and college.
Fascinating. And I'm sure it's going to come back in the longer arc of your career to be very useful in some situation.
Yeah. You know, it may also have built some of those cold reach out skills. There was a lot of kind of Facebook marketplace, right, messaging people, meeting up, all that kind of thing. So yeah, maybe something came from there to where I am today as well.
Yeah. Axel, absolute pleasure. Ways that people can connect to you, reach out to you. What's the best way?
Yeah, LinkedIn is the best way. Axel Orstrom. I think there'll be a link in the show notes and spelled just the same way as it'll be in the title. So yeah, if anyone's interested in talking about any of the things we discussed or just connecting for future reference, feel free to reach out on LinkedIn.
Axel, great conversation. Very helpful. And thank you for spending your time. I know you're incredibly busy, so thank you.
Thank you for having me. Yeah, this is great. Let's do this again sometime.
Will do.
Thanks for listening to 97% Effective, where we skip happy talk and help you break through and ascend one hard truth at a time. Help others discover this show. Leave a review and rating wherever you listen to your podcasts. And if you like what you heard, you can get free resources, including the first chapters of Michael's book, Get Promoted, on his website, www.changwinderoth.com. That's www.changwenderoth.com.
Don't miss the biggest Maytag sale of the year at Lowe's. You'll find the Maytag appliances you need when you need them at a great price. Plus, when you buy two select laundry appliances, you'll get up to a $100 bonus via instant rebate. Shop Maytag at Lowe's. We help, you save. Offer valid through 531. See store for pricing and offer details. Advertise savings on all major Maytag appliances through Maytag.com and participating retailers. Prices may vary. Additional terms and conditions apply.